Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll-free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now, with today's topic, here is James White.
And good afternoon. Welcome to The Dividing Line, a special edition of The Dividing Line. 90 minutes today. Don't know how you can stand it. But I wanted to have enough time today to not have to rush through the material that I wanted to present on the subject of theology matters, and it matters especially in the field of apologetics. Once again, this morning I was doing my study, which means I was writing, and I listened to the debate that took place not very long ago between Dinesh D'Souza and Dan Barker. Obviously, I'm listening to everything by Dan Barker these days because 2 weeks from today, we will be debating at the University of Illinois. And as I listened to this debate, there was once again those couple of times where anyone, at one point, I specifically know that I was riding along a certain spot behind some houses. And if someone was in the backyard of their house, they would have heard me yelling, "Just answer his question." And unfortunately, I wasn't yelling at Dan Barker. It seemed to me that there were so many opportunities that were just completely missed in this debate, and that's because theology matters. That is, Dinesh D'Souza is a Roman Catholic. And I'm afraid that many people just do not understand why it is that there is a fundamental difference in how we defend the faith between those who specifically seek to follow the Scriptures as the sole infallible rule of faith and those who do not. But there is a fundamental difference, or at least there should be. For there are many who call themselves Protestants who, like Roman Catholics, have a hobbled, a crippled apologetic. It is not a thoroughly biblical apologetic. It is not an apostolic apologetic. It is not how the apostles defended the faith. This is something we've talked about many times. When you hear someone presenting a probability argument for the existence of God, you're listening to someone who is not following an apostolic example. That is not how the apostles proclaimed the gospel or defended the proclamation of the gospel either. And that's what I heard in this program. I want to start off, this particular debate, I'm sorry, I want to start off with some difficult words. One of the reasons that Cornelius Van Til is difficult for people to follow is because English was not his primary language. And as such, reading Van Til is not easy. It is not something that can be sped read in any way. But he brings out some important issues, and you're going to hear the practical ramifications of this material. I'm reading here from his book, Christian Apologetics. Now, the edition that I have is actually rather old. It's from P&R from many, many moons ago, and it's rather poorly typeset. But let me try to work through some of this with you, lay the foundation so that as we listen to this debate, you will be able to see why I keep emphasizing these things. I think it's extremely important. I think there are many solid biblical Christians who think that as long as you're a theist, we're all on the same page, we're all on the same side. That simply isn't the case. There are people who defend the existence of God, but they do so in such a way that they are defending the existence of a general deity rather than the Christian God of Scripture. And when you bring someone or pretend to bring someone to the faith with sub-biblical argumentation, and then you attempt to introduce them to the fullness of what the Bible teaches, which may not happen in many of these types of churches anyway, certainly not in Roman Catholicism, Then they see the dissonance that exists, the contradiction that exists between the arguments you used to get them there, and then what you actually want them to end up believing. This was brought home to me very clearly by a presuppositionalist professor that I had at Fuller Seminary, and I had never heard of any of this stuff. This was the exact same time when I began to encounter Reformed theology. It all happened at one time, from two different directions, which I'm very thankful for in hindsight. But I was blown away when he stood in front of our class and he said, Thomas Aquinas proved the wrong God. Now, all I had ever heard of was Aquinas. I mean, about the only thing you could get if you went out to a bookstore would be something like from Norman Geisler or something like that, that classical apologetics or whatever it might be, and it was the standard arguments that are used, and that's what I just thought there was, and so I couldn't understand why he was saying what he was saying, but he was basically saying you cannot start with the creation, reason from the creation to the Creator in the way that Aquinas attempted to do, and that was a shock to me. I didn't accept that at first. But thankfully, he was having us read Schaeffer. He was having us read Blaise Pascal's Le Pensée. And at the same time, I started reading a book by R.C. Sproul, and that was the end of that. So that was part of my coming to understand these things. But let me try to explain why it is that there is such a fundamental difference, and then we will, in the rest of the dividing line, help people to understand what the situation is. This is from page 16 of Christian Apologetics. Roman Catholic, let me just back up here. In conjunction with man's false ideal of knowledge, we may mention here the fact that when man thought he could not attain his own false ideal of knowledge, he blamed this to his finite character. Man confused finitude with sin. Thus, he commingled the metaphysical and the ethical aspects of reality, not willing to take the blame for sin. Man laid it to circumstances round about him or within him. You know what? Back up even more, because I'm just going to read this. I'm going to back up even more, because I think you need it. On the question of epistemology, as on that of metaphysics, the Roman Catholic Church again occupies a straddling position. With non-Christian forms of epistemology in general, and with Aristotle in particular, its most basic concept is that of knowledge in general. This is naturally involved in the Aristotelian idea of being in general. Roman Catholicism not only admits, but it maintains that Aristotle was right in assuming that it is possible to say something intelligible about being in general. Accordingly, it follows Aristotle in speaking of the requirements to which knowledge in general must answer if it is to be true with Aristotle. Romanism assumes that God and man, listen to this, stand in exactly the same sort of relation to the law of contradiction. To think and know truly, it is assumed, both must think in accordance with that law as an abstraction from the nature of either. So God and us, we both have to think in the same way, and there's this law above God. This law of non-contradiction, it's above God, and God has to answer that law. See, that was my insertion because it was in more flowing English. Going back to Van Til. The consequences are again fatal both for systematic theology and apologetics. For systematic theology, it means the truth is not made ultimately to consist in correspondence to the internally self-complete nature and knowledge that God has of himself and of all created reality. Hence, man's dealings in the realm of truth are not ultimately with God, but with an abstraction that stands above God with truth, capital T, truth, as such. For apologetics, it means the basic principle of the non-Christian conception of truth cannot be challenged. According to this most basic assumption, it is man rather than God that is the final reference point in all predication. The idea of truth in the abstract is in accord with this assumption. In fact, the idea of truth in the abstract is based upon this assumption. A moment's reflection upon the fall of man in paradise will prove this to be true. In paradise, God said to man that if he ate of the forbidden fruit, he would surely die. The truth about the facts in the created universe, Adam and Eve were told in effect, could be known ultimately only if one knew their relationship to the plan of God. It is this plan of God that makes all created facts to be what they are. Granted that man's activity with respect to many facts is a factor in making him what they are, even so, it remains true that back of everything that man might do, it is ultimately God's plan that is all-controlling. And this plan is in accord with the being or nature of God. God did not, because he could not, look up to an abstract principle of truth, capital T truth, above himself, in order, in accordance with it, to fashion the world. Satan, however, suggested to Eve that God's statement about the relation of one temporal fact to another was not determinative of the nature of that relationship. Facts and the truth about the relationships to one another can be known by man, Satan contended, in effect, without getting any information about them from God as their maker and controller. I just step out again. In other words, what Satan is doing is he's tempting Eve to think in separation from God, not only in rebellion from God, but to think in a way not dependent upon God's own nature and God's own revelation. I go back to Van Til. How can they thus be known in the first place? By observation. But observation is not sufficient. Man needed to know something about the future. God pretended to interpret the future relationships of temporal facts to one another, that is, through giving his law. In rejecting God's interpretation of the future relationship of temporal facts to one another, man could only rest upon the powers of logical thought within himself. Mere observation of facts could not help him to offer a substitute prediction for that of God, for there was as yet no past. So man had to depend upon his powers of logic alone, and he had to assume that these powers could somehow legislate for what is to be in the future. He had, in short, to assume that his powers of logic could legislate for what is possible and impossible in reality about him. Keep that in mind. If anything has struck me in Dan Barker's Fundamentalist Humanism, that is a good description of it right there. Man had to depend upon his powers of logic alone. He had to assume that these powers could somehow legislate for what is to be in the future. He had, in short, to assume that his powers of logic could legislate for what is possible and impossible in reality about him. He had to say, in effect, that what God said would come about could not possibly come about. And he had to find this power of legislation exclusively within himself. He had as yet no experience about the course of nature. He could appeal to no law of truth in any objective sense. He had to choose between taking the divine mind or his own mind as the source of truth about all facts. Truth, out of all relationship to any mind, is a pure meaningless abstraction. Now, Roman Catholicism, bound as it is to its most basic notion of supposedly intelligent predication about being in general, is unable to place this alternative before men. It cannot challenge those who make man the center of their interpretation of life, with a view that makes God the center of the interpretation of life. And Till was not exactly ecumenical in his perspectives. So, back to, let's see here, what I had been saying before. On page 17, just two more paragraphs and I'll look at some others. In the view of knowledge, the Romanist view of man involves both rationalism and irrationalism. These correspond to determinism and indeterminism in the realm of being. The Roman Catholic apologist will make his final appeal to knowledge in general instead of to the self-conscious ontological trinity. He will try to prove the existence of God by the method of Aristotle, that is, by showing that God's existence is in accord with logic in general. So doing, he does not prove the existence of the ontological trinity. Listen to this. He proves the existence of a small g God. A small g God that fits into the pattern of being in general. And he will prove that this God probably exists. For man has no experience of any sort of being except as such as lies at the edge of non-being. Thus, Romanism cannot challenge the interpretations of the non-Christians, seeking to appeal to the reason of the natural man, as the natural man himself interprets his reason. The Roman Catholic apologist falls victim both of the rationalism and the irrationalism inherent in the non-Christian view of life. How many times have we listened to William Lane Craig and those who follow William Lane Craig argue that the preponderance of the evidence points to the greater probability of the existence of a God? It needs to be understood that William Lane Craig is standing upon a Roman Catholic epistemology. He is not thoroughly Protestant in his perspectives. And if you don't see how that was relevant to what happened with Frank Beckwith, then you're not aware of that situation. Continuing, in the field of ethics, the Romanist view involves both dictatorship and autonomy. These correspond to determinism and indeterminism in the field of being, and to rationalism and irrationalism in the field of knowledge. The average man is virtually said to be properly subject, in absolute sense, papal authority, to such of their fellow men as have attained to a higher position than they have in the scale of being. The relationship between those in authority and those under authority is not exclusively or even primarily ethical, but metaphysical. The Pope, to be sure, speaks for Christ on Christ's authority, but the only Christ he knows is one who, though God as well as man, yet fits into a certain position in the scale of being. Thus, even the Pope deals not exclusively or primarily with the Creator-Redeemer, but with being in general and knowledge in general. He derives his authority not primarily from revelation given him by Christ, but from his supposedly superior insight into the proper proportions within the scale of being. He is an expert in the realm of religion. The average man must listen to him as to a dictator. Well, there's much more there, but I'm already burning through some time here. Moving to The Defense of the Faith by Cornelius Van Til. Just a couple things here, and then we'll start listening to the debate. This is in the section on the Reformed position, but I want to read the section where he's contrasting this with both Roman Catholicism and Protestant evangelicalism. But let me give you at least the last paragraph of Presenting the Reformed Position. This is on page 92 if you have the same book. It is only when we begin our approach to the question of the point of contact, by thus analyzing the situation as it obtained in paradise before the fall of man, that we can attain to a true conception of the natural man and his capacities with respect to the truth. The Apostle Paul speaks of the natural man as actually possessing the knowledge of God. Romans 1:19-21. Oh, I can't tell you how important that is. The natural man possesses but suppresses the knowledge of God. The greatness of his sin lies precisely in the fact that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God. No man can escape knowing God. It is indelibly involved in his awareness of anything whatsoever. Man ought, therefore, as Calvin puts it, to recognize God. There is no excuse for him if he does not. The reason for his failure to recognize God lies exclusively in him. It is due to his willful transgression of the very law of his being. Neither Romanism nor Protestant evangelicalism can do full justice to this teaching of Paul. In effect, both of them fail to surround man exclusively with God's revelation, not holding to the counsel of God as all-controlling. They cannot teach that man's self-awareness always presupposes awareness of God. According to both Rome and evangelicalism, man may have some measure of awareness of objects about him and of himself in relation to them without being aware at the same time of his responsibility to manipulate both of them in relation to God. Thus, man's consciousness of objects, of self, of time, and of history are not from the outset brought into an exclusive relationship of dependence upon God. Of course, when we thus stress Paul's teaching that all men do not have a mere capacity for, but are in actual possession of the knowledge of God, we have at once to add Paul's further instruction to the effect that all men, due to the sin within them, always and in all relationships seek to suppress this knowledge of God, Romans 1:18. The natural man is such a one as constantly throws water on a fire he cannot quench. He has yielded the temptation of Satan and has become his bondservant. When Satan tempted Adam and Eve in paradise, he sought to make them believe that man's self-consciousness was ultimate rather than derivative and God-dependent. He argued, as it were, that it was of the nature of self-consciousness to make itself the final reference point of all predication. He argued, as it were, that God had no control over all that might come forth in the process of time. That is to say, he argued, in effect, that as any form of self-consciousness must assume its own ultimacy, so it must also admit its own limitation in the fact that much of that happens is under no control at all. Thus, Satan argued, as it were, that man's consciousness of time and of time's products in history is, if intelligible at all, intelligible in some measure independently of God. Romanism and evangelicalism, however, do not attribute this assumption of autonomy or ultimacy on the part of man as due to sin. Note this, if you're losing something here. Romanism and evangelicalism, however, do not attribute this assumption of autonomy or ultimacy on the part of man as due to sin. They hold that man should quite properly think of himself and of his relation to objects in time in this way. And that is exactly what is part and parcel of both of those theologies, Arminianism and Roman Catholicism, both assert this very thing. Hence, they do injustice to Paul's teaching with respect to the effect of sin on the interpretive activity of man, as they virtually deny that originally man not merely had a capacity for the truth, but was in actual possession of the truth, so also they virtually deny that the natural man suppresses the truth. It is not to be wondered at that neither Romanism nor Evangelicalism are little interested in challenging the philosophers when these, as Calvin says, interpret man's consciousness without being aware of the tremendous difference in man's attitude toward the truth before and after the fall. Accordingly, they do not distinguish carefully between the natural man's own conception of himself and the biblical conception of him. Yet, for the question of the point of contact, this is all important. If we make our appeal to the natural man without being aware of this distinction, we virtually admit that the natural man's estimate of himself is correct. There is the absolute touchstone on why it is that sub-biblical apologetics cannot be consistent, and I would assert does not glorify God. Let me read it again. Yet for the question of the point of contact, what's our point of contact? Is there a neutral point of contact? Can we assume neutrality? No, we cannot. To do so is to deny everything we believe. So what's the point of contact? If we make our appeal to the natural man without being aware of this distinction, we virtually admit that the natural man's estimate of himself is correct. We may, to be sure, even then maintain that he is in need of information. We may even admit that he is morally corrupt. But the one thing which, on this basis, we cannot admit is that his claim to be able to interpret at least some area of experience in a way that is essentially correct is mistaken. We cannot then challenge his most basic epistemological assumption to the effect that his self-consciousness and time-consciousness are self-explanatory. We cannot challenge his right to interpret all his experience in exclusively immanentistic categories. And on this everything hinges, for if we first allow the legitimacy of the natural man's assumption of himself as the ultimate reference point in interpretation in any dimension, we cannot deny his right to interpret Christianity itself in naturalistic terms. There is so much more that I would highly recommend to you. The Defense of the Faith, it is not easy reading, but it is more than worthwhile reading. But what you're going to hear is the truthfulness of everything I just read to you, repeated over and over and over again in much more simple terms. But we needed to lay that foundation. Because in listening to this debate today, again, there were times that I'm going, yes, that's a valid point. That's a valid point because I'm listening to a theist debating an atheist. And I listened to, you know, Dan Barker, and you know, the fact is Dan Barker says wrong things. He says in here the thing he says all the time. He says, the term for kill in the Old Testament does not mean murder. It only means kill. No Hebrew scholar on the planet would ever back him up on that, because Hebrew scholars know something called semantic domains, and they know something about context. And it just drives me nuts when I hear stuff like that, because it's just so obviously fallacious, but so rarely gets challenged. But still, the point is that listening to opportunity after opportunity after opportunity go by in this debate was extremely difficult to listen to. A couple things about the debate. First of all, it was a horrible debate in organization. I would never let myself get involved in this. It was at Harvard, as I recall. And there was basically no meaningful opening statement. There was almost no interaction, almost no cross-examination. It was nothing but a CNN-style short questions and answers. And that's horrible. Secondly, it doesn't seem that either debater had what I'm holding in my hand, a stopwatch, a thing to let you know how much time you have left. Over and over and over again, a person is mid-sentence or starting another point when they get interrupted and shut down. And it just, you know, maybe that's how you do it in the modern day, where you have people whose attention span is only approximately 30 seconds to 2 minutes at the most. I mean, you're really stretching them at that point. But it really makes it difficult to develop almost anything. So on both of those levels, it was just horrific. along those lines. The organization was all wrong, and the interaction was all wrong, and it was just terrible. But still, the things that came out, hopefully, in light of what we just said, will be of some assistance. So let's get to these. Let's start with this clip right here.
The Word of God. So how can you feel confident that yours is the one that's truly divinely inspired?
Sorry, started that a little bit behind that. This is a question about, given all these world scriptures, how can you know that yours is divinely inspired? Here's the first example of theology matters.
I see religions as a human effort to apprehend the divine. In this sense, the presence of the divine, the transcendent God, can be defended and to a large degree known by reason, what Kant called religion within the limits of reason alone. Now, religion ultimately is based on two dimensions. You may say the dimension of reason and the dimension of revelation. It is impossible to use reason to adjudicate between competing revelations. In that sense, I have no way of saying that Christianity is, in its revelation, better or truer than other religions. I can't say that based on reason. In fact, when the end of the world comes, I guess we'll know if the phone call turns out to be from Salt Lake City. Big surprise to all of us, won't it be?
I stopped there just for a moment with my mouth hanging open. Theology matters. Oh, we can't do these things with reason. What? Such a fundamental difference as to how we even view divine revelation, the sufficiency of Scripture, between the rather liberal Roman Catholic and the believing Christian. Coming out right there. Hey, we might get a phone call from the Mormons. Who knows? What do you mean? You cannot demonstrate the supremacy and superiority of the Bible over the Book of Mormon? Again, the absolutely hamstringing of any meaningful apologetic on this level. What kind of Christianity is being defended here? It's certainly not the supernatural Christianity of the apostles. And that's the problem. You see, if you bring somebody to a non-supernatural, philosophically based Christianity that has no basis for the biblical discussions of living under the lordship of Christ and taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ and all the rest of this, what are you leading them to? Are they not even in more danger there than they were before because now they think they have Christianity? I think it's a good question.
Look, I want to make a little different point. The way I look at it is somewhat different. I see religion as an effort to bridge the gap. We all sense in our life a chasm between the way we are and, you might say, the way we should be. We sense a chasm between our life as it is and perfection. And by perfection, what I mean is perfect beauty, perfect goodness, perfect truth, and so on. So here is this huge divide. Religion is an effort to try to bridge that. And I see the major Abrahamic religions, particularly, by the way, Judaism and Islam, as a way to construct a ladder, a human ladder to God. If you follow these codes, these commandments, these dietary regulations, pray five times a day, go to Mecca, you're going to move up the rungs of the ladder. Eastern religions similarly view the problem as the self. And if you can extinguish the self, you'll achieve in some senses what the Buddhists call nirvana. Now, Christianity is based on the premise that this divide, this chasm is so big that no human effort will ever bridge it. And therefore, the only way to bridge it, if it is going to be bridged, is God must in some sense descend down. He must condescend to the human level. And this is what I see in the incarnation of Christ. In a sense, God, if you will, leaning down and closing this gap. And I think, speaking anthropologically, speaking on pure reason, looking at the world as it is, this seems to me a more realistic assessment of the way it's going to have to happen. I don't see a way for us. We are made, Immanuel Kant said, out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made. I don't think man on his own can make his way to God. God has to make his way to man. For these reasons, quite apart from whether the Bible is true as opposed to the Quran, I don't want to get into that kind of hocus-pocus debate. I want to debate today not by quoting the Bible, not by flinging scriptural verses. I want to debate based on history and philosophy and science, the same rational evidence that the atheists appeal to. My goal is ultimately to defeat atheism on its own ground.
All right. Thank you, Mr. D'Souza. Mr. Brucker, you have 90 seconds to respond.
Well, you did not answer the question. And Dinesh is obviously a very kind and very smart individual. And I admire someone like him. But tonight, all he's doing is equivocating. I think you can see that.
Yes, I can. What an amazing thing. Hocus pocus. As was just pointed out in channel, how ironic for a Roman Catholic to be using hocus pocus. But how is it... how do you prove a supernatural faith? How do you substantiate the truth claims of Christianity based upon natural reason that treats divine revelation in this way? How do you do it? What are you trying to bring people to? I'm not going to tell you, I'm not going to quote anything about what God said. I'm going to quote Immanuel Kant all the time. Well, that's great. But what are you trying to accomplish? There's a fundamental difference between what the apologist who is trying to, the incremental apologist. And what I mean by an incremental apologist is an individual who thinks that you're accomplishing something for God by bringing someone a little closer to the truth, a little less pagan. This is the approach some use with Mormonism. Well, if we could get them to be, you know, just, how about just three gods instead of an infinite number of gods? That somehow is better. Then a few generations down the road, we can try to get them down to one god, and then we can eventually try to repair the Trinity. And instead of the apostolic example, found in Galatians, you once worshiped those which are by nature not gods. You once worshiped them. We called you to repentance for that idolatry. Very politically incorrect, but politically correct apologetics will never lead you to biblical Christianity because biblical Christianity is not politically correct. So those that are using that just are wasting resources and time and everything else in the process. Now, that doesn't mean that God could use a crooked stick to draw a straight line, and God might use imperfect apologetics. At least I sure hope he does because I'm not perfect. But this is a fundamental difference in approach as to how you do apologetics. It truly, truly is. Well, here's the next question that was, well, not the next, but here's the next question that I've selected. And again, how different my response would be than offered by D'Souza.
Our next question is for Mr. D'Souza. We often hear Christians citing Bible verse or Bible principles as proof of morality and immorality. But some of these principles, such as those that pertain to slavery or intense physical punishment, are considered outdated today and are largely ignored by the Christian contingency. Do you believe that some traditional Christian morals are outdated? If so, is it possible that any of today's religious ethics will someday be obsolete?
Mr. Souza, you have 2 minutes.
Let's look for a moment at the single and strongest example you gave, which is the example of slavery. Now, slavery has been a universal institution. The Chinese had it, the Indians had it. It was slavery all over Africa. American Indians had slaves long before Columbus. For centuries, slavery was uncontroversial. It required no defenders because it had no critics. It is only in one civilization, the civilization of the West, also known as Christendom, that slavery became controversial. Not, by the way, in the modern era. Many people think this was some sort of enlightenment idea. No. Between the 4th century and the 10th century, slavery virtually disappeared from Europe, being replaced by serfdom. Very different from slavery. Then in the modern era, first the Quakers and then the evangelical Christians began to say the following. If we are all created equal in the eyes of God, a theological premise, it follows, politically, that no man has the right to rule another man without his consent. this startling idea, and I admit it's a new interpretation of a very old theological principle, this startling interpretation becomes the basis not only of anti-slavery or abolition, it also becomes the basis of democracy. Because what is the premise of democracy, representative democracy? No man has the right to rule another without consent. These ideas have no clear secular roots. Even Jefferson, who was the most secular of all the founders, the least of a believer, when he came down to saying, what is the source of our rights? He didn't name four sources, he named only one, our Creator. Our rights come directly, he thought, from God. The simple assumption of the sacredness of human life, he could think of no other source. And he was a pretty smart guy. And he was a very scientifically minded guy, than God. So my point is, what you call outdated, yes, slavery is outdated, that's because Christianity made it outdated.
Thank
if
you.
It wasn't...
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Souza.
By the way, you pay half as much for a female slave as for a male slave. Jesus talked about there are some slaves who ought to be beat harder than others. You would have thought that this wonderful lawgiver, this wonderful, omnipotent, powerful deity who's coming to give us advice, would have said something about it in one of his parables, maybe? He would have said, by the way, slavery is a bad idea. No, he incorporated slavery.
Notice what Dan does. He recognizes that D'Souza, well, all that's interesting. And all that may be true. And it is interesting to notice that slavery was a universal thing. All of that's true. But how does it help this person to recognize the supremacy of the Word of God and the propriety of the Word of God and how it handled slavery? It doesn't. What should have been said is we need to understand that while the Bible does not condemn slavery, it provides specific guidelines to rule over it. In other words, it allows for the message, either the Old Testament message in regards to the Jews, and then in the New Testament, written to people, most of whom were slaves. Most of whom were in that situation. And what does the Bible tell them? Honor your masters, even those who are not Christians, even those who are not kind to you. Do it to glorify God. It doesn't say start a revolution. The gospel gets to go to every single nation. Nations with slavery and nations without slavery. Slavery was part and parcel of the economic system of the day. To simply say, oh, everyone needs to abolish slavery, would have meant that for Christianity to enter into any place in the Roman Empire would have required revolution and armed revolution at that. So what is being demanded of the revelation, and Barker does this all the time, from Barker's perspective, the revelation had to be given in the 21st century. It had to be given in a modern context, speak to modern context, the fact that it was given to those old, ignorant people back then. He suffers horribly from modernist syndrome, but to give it in such a way that it speaks to the reality of whatever culture it enters into, that never even crosses their mind. The fact that it regulated Hebrew slavery and even allowed for slaves who loved their masters to become permanent slaves, as in part of the household. Oh, we never mention anything like that. No. We don't talk about anything like that. No, this is just a bludgeon to beat on the Bible and ignore the historical context in which it is found. And that needs to be, and you see, so many Christians need to hear this because this is very, very common. You need to be able to point out that slavery was the essence of the economic system of that time. We're talking about employers and employees. And so to just simply say, oh, well, it should have been abolitionist from the very, very foundation. Yeah, it's right. It laid the foundation of abolition. And there are all sorts of errors in the non-Hebraic form of slavery in the Old Testament. There are all sorts of things that were violations of God's law that ignored those things. But the fact of the matter is that what you're demanding, if you're saying that the New Testament, the Christian church from the very beginning should have been saying, get rid of slavery. Think about that. When 75% maybe of your members are slaves, what have you just forced Christianity to be? It's a revolution. It's a rebel army. And you are inviting not only the persecution that Christianity experienced, but you're inviting the legions to march against you in a situation like that. And so that just needs to be brought out, needs to be said. but wasn't in that situation. And of course, then Dan jumped all over it and, you know, again starts going after the Bible because he knows if the one person is not defending the Bible and will not defend the Bible and will not get into even talking about the Bible while he is attacking the Bible out of, so often out of context. He goes, oh, I'm always in context. Baloney. It's not even close. But since he does that, and the other side's not defending it, what's the ultimate response? Again, here's another example of theology matters.
He understands that your mind, your state of mind is important. And your works are also important. There's been, of course, a big debate between Catholicism and the Protestant churches on this very point. Is it faith or is it works? Look, I see this as a hair-splitting debate. Ultimately, I see faith and works, or intentions and effects, as working as the two sides of a scissors.
So, the entire issue of the Reformation was a hair-splitting debate. And evidently, on both sides. So, I would imagine that the Roman Catholics, the Tridentine Roman Catholics, who hold to the condemnations of sola fide in the Council of Trent, will hear that and go, what are you talking about? I did look up online on, there was a link to an article about him, and I think he described himself as a believing but not very good practicing Catholic. Well, there I think you have a pretty decent example of that, to be sure, in regards to that. This next one, again, how would you respond? This is, most people know that especially on this one, I would have packed a lot into the 2 minutes that I was given, but I didn't get to be there. So here is the next section.
So what are your views on abortion and capital punishment? Do you attach a different value to the life of a fetus than to that of a convict?
If you, Mr. D'Souza, if you'd like to answer first.
I think of abortion and capital punishment as in some ways related and in some ways distinct. They're clearly related in the sense that they both involve the taking of life. They, in some ways, involve the deliberate taking of life. In that sense, an element of intentionality is involved in both situations. They're different for the reason that we discussed earlier, and that is the question of guilt or innocence. I think it would be hard to argue in any sense that a fetus, assuming it has a right to life, deserves to die. One feminist writer described the fetus as an uninvited guest, which it may be in the womb. But even so, it is morally in a very different position than the guy, the serial killer, who goes out and massacres, let's say, five people at Virginia Tech or more. So that's the key difference. Abortion is a difficult issue. My own thinking on it has been shaped a little bit by looking at the Lincoln-Douglas debates, which are very fascinating. And by the way, I'm not making some crude analogy with slavery. But the Lincoln-Douglas debates were ultimately over what to do about the expansion of slavery into the territories. Interestingly, Douglas argued the pro-choice view. Douglas said, listen, I don't care if you have slavery. I don't care if you don't have it. I am indifferent to whether slavery is voted up or down. But I think we should agree to disagree. We shouldn't have a rule. We should let each state, each community decide for itself if it wants to vote yes or no on slavery. Lincoln made a very profound rebuttal to this. He says you cannot defend choice without attention to the content of what is being chosen. This is a moral evasion. He says ultimately the real question is the Negro a human being or is the Negro the moral equivalent of a hog? If the Negro is the moral equivalent of a hog, then my opponent is right. We can decide up or down. We can be morally indifferent. But if the fetus is a human being, or if the slave is a human being, the question settles itself. Choice becomes irrelevant. So, similarly on the abortion issue, I would like to see a little bit more. There's too much easy refuge in the principle of choice. I think that that evades something that we as a society like to evade, and that is the status of the unborn. And this is particularly ironic in an age of compassion, at a time when you may say the orbits of compassion are stretching further out to encompass, in some cases, not only the marginalized groups, but in some cases even animals. Peter Singer, who I'll be debating on Friday in L.A., wants apes to have the rights enshrined in the U.N. Charter. So we are going beyond our species. We are reaching far wide, apparently the only candidate for exemption in this widening circle of moral compassion is the one candidate that gets in our way.
Thank you, Mr. D'Souza. Mr. Barker, same question.
I don't speak for all atheists, obviously. There are some atheists who are anti-abortion. There are some atheists who are pro-death penalty. Most of the atheists that I know happen to be socially liberal, but not all of them. But I can speak for myself at least tonight. The humanistic morality really is not concerned with punishment. Humanistic morality is concerned with protecting society from unnecessary harm. So a humanist, being ethical, would say we need to exercise the minimal amount of protection or restraint necessary to avoid harm, unnecessary harm to society. We think that capital punishment crosses that line. We think there are ways to protect society. We don't care if that prisoner feels bad or feels punished. I mean, that's not our business. What we care is that society is protected. So, speaking for myself, it is, if we're trying to tell people killing is wrong, and if you do it, we're going to kill you, the state's going to kill you, well, then that, the state is just as complicit in killing and is just as immoral. Other atheists disagree with me, but that's my position as a humanistic atheist. I support a woman's right to choose an abortion. Jesus never said anything about a woman with an unwanted pregnancy. He was silent on the issue. I think Christians should be as well. I think for most women, an abortion is a blessing in her life. It is a wonderful thing. Obviously, there's a difference between a fetus that's the size of a thumb that has what would you put it in a little locket hanging around your neck? It's not a fully developed, it's like the difference between an acorn and a tree. Obviously, there's some potential there. Every sperm has potential. Every sperm wants to be a future being as well. And yet we don't make masturbation a crime, right? So we have to make moral distinctions. And I think the reason I support a woman's right to choose is that it's her problem. It's her issue. It's none of your business or mine to butt in with her private decision with her doctor and with her priest and her rabbi and her lawyer.
Thank you, Mr. Barker. In the interest of time, we're going to skip it.
Now, Barker's response was just absolutely pathetic. I would love to debate every issue he brought up. For example, the sperm, if you leave a sperm alone, if you don't kill a sperm, will you end up with a human being with a unique genetic code? No. Evidently size determines personhood. Well, it's really teeny and tiny, but if you don't kill it, what will it become? What is it? It's human, is it not? In fact, it's absolutely unique. Yeah, it is. Anyway. Taking apart the imbecilic argumentations of those who support the murder of unborn children is not difficult to do if you really have invested much time in the preparation of so doing. It's funny. It's not funny. It's sad and disgusting that Dan Barker likes to say there's no big M morality out there. Like there's a huge stomach and you've got digestion and digestion's a thing. He constantly contradicts himself on that. And he just did here. Well, you know, the good of the society. The big capital G good of the society. How is it good of society? That millions and millions of unique individuals who had unique talents and capacities have been destroyed and killed since Roe v. Wade. How is society aided and assisted in this way? Well, there's fewer of us. Yeah, there you go. This kind of thinking is amazing. But again, I go back to D'Souza's response. How is that a response? Why, emphasize the fact that there is a fundamental difference between the criminal who has broken God's law and man's law and is a danger to society and to others. Then emphasize the fact that his punishment is not just, well, put these people away so that they don't hurt us because society is all good. Do you hear that in Barker's stuff? We don't care about punishment. Well, of course they don't care about punishment. All we are ugly bags of water. All we are random atoms bouncing around against each other. So punishment's irrelevant. There's no such thing as justice. There's no such thing as transcendent values or anything like that. Of course, every person who has been wronged knows there's such a thing as justice and desires it, but that's just simply something going on between your ears, and it stops when you go to sleep. When you die, it's no longer relevant. That's the essence of his functional atheistic humanistic morality. But still, when D'Souza has 2 minutes to talk about the horrific degradation of mankind inherent in abortion, and the fact that not punishing evildoers likewise degrades humanity, you don't get any of that. Well, it's because we were at Harvard. Well, you know, the people at Harvard are deeply deceived, and they need to hear the truth. And there was a situation where that that didn't happen. So let's press on as we have only 40 minutes left in the program, already halfway through the extended version of the program today. Let's press on.
What I'm trying to do is something perhaps a little different. There's Christian apologetics, and most of it goes on within the churches. What I'm trying to do, if you will, is engage atheism on its own ground. So you'll notice, for example, that at no point today have I appealed to authority or revelation or an encyclical or even scripture. I've essentially argued on the same terms as Dan Barker. And that's why it shocks me that he basically says these religious views have to be somehow excluded from the public square because they are dangerous. Meanwhile, apparently his views are perfectly safe and they should have a monopoly in the public square. This strikes
me
as ludicrous.
Thank you.
It strikes me as ludicrous as well, that specific aspect. But what strikes me as even more ludicrous is a Christian who thinks that reasoning on the same level as the atheist is going to somehow substantiate the supernatural truth claims of Christianity. This goes back to what I spent the first 20 minutes reading. And if you sort of zoned out and you said, oh, man, read something more relevant, this is where the rubber meets the road. This is where those foundational issues of how we know what we know and what is a consistent Christian epistemology come to bear in the real world, standing in front of students at Harvard, in the marketplace of ideas. This is where this all comes to fruition. And probably, I believe, this isn't it, but this is getting close to where I was yelling as I was running along today, but this one's fairly close. Let's listen.
Mr. D'Souza, I'd like to ask you a question. You stated that the God was omniscient earlier in the presentation. Now, accepting that term, I would like for you to ask how an omniscient entity, when creating this planet and the human beings, could screw up so badly. They had Adam and Eve, their first progeny was a murderer, and going through 10 or 15 generations, this omniscient entity had to acknowledge that he had made such a mess that every man, woman, and child was murdered by drowning. And not too long after that, he murdered his own so-called begotten son to correct for these failures of his own creation. And this doesn't sound like an omniscient entity to my understanding of the English words. I mean, I would expect competence.
Yes.
Now, I think he has 2 minutes to respond. Maybe it's only 1 minute. I'm not sure. But again, the response to such a presentation, how are you going to handle it? Well, it depends on what you believe. Now, obviously, there are going to be some audience questions 2 weeks from today. And let's say someone stands up and asks that question. And I have a very brief period of time to respond. In fact, I'm going to limit it. I think, looking at this, he only has one minute here. Let me look here. 29. We're currently at 28:10. It goes 29:30. He has 90 seconds. 90 seconds. So I'm gonna put 90 seconds on my little clock here, and I'll respond, and then we'll see how Dinesh D'Souza responds to the question. Well, sir, of course, the problem with your question is that it ignores what Christians believe, specifically in regards to the fact that God not only is omniscient, but he is omniscient because he has a sovereign decree that has determined everything that takes place in time. So God has a purpose for all the things that you call screw-ups. You may not understand what they are now. We as creatures do not have an exhaustive knowledge of what God's decree is, but he assures us that everything that takes place has a purpose in his decree that will eventually lead to his glorification. And so what you have described is not a matter of incompetence. It is a matter of our ignorance, and especially in our state of rebellion, our unwillingness to allow God to define his own creation. The scriptures tell us that he is created with a purpose, and that purpose has included sin, and that purpose has included redemption from sin through the person of Jesus Christ to his own glory. So none of those things were quote-unquote screw-ups. They were on our part, but not on God's part. They are part and parcel of the plan that he is working out in this world. And so what that means is the Christian believes that there is a purpose even in the existence of evil, and that God is going to glorify himself through the redemption of a peculiar people and through the punishment of those who love their sin. So in answer to your question, sir, you would need to look to the God of the Bible to have a full understanding of what his purposes really are. And that was with 2 seconds left at the end. That's why you need one of these things, so you can try to wrap things up. Let's listen to what Dinesh D'Souza said.
When I was at Dartmouth, one of the things I learned was in answering an objection, in critiquing a view, always try first to state the view from the inside. Try to state the view as the advocate of that view might hold it, and then attack that, because otherwise you're attacking a straw man. Now, the first thing I would say is, what is the Christian understanding of omniscience, and is the God that we see in the world inconsistent with that? The Christian understanding of omniscience is the following. Number one, God created the universe and a lawful universe. God created man and woman and created them with free will. Now, he could have done it differently. He could have created us automatons. He could have made us robots. The Christian view is that for whatever reason, and you can dispute it, he created free will. Now, freedom in the essence of it, and Dan swears by freedom as his core principle. As you know, freedom is the freedom to choose the good, but it is not freedom if it doesn't have the equivalent freedom to deny the good, to choose the evil. And so Christians are not surprised to see evil in the world, particularly moral evil. It is the direct consequence of giving human beings free will.
Thank you.
Now,
well, that is a very standard answer. It is not a Reformed answer, it's not a biblical answer, and it answers absolutely positively nothing. Because, well, it's because free will. God gave us free will, and that's why there's evil in the world. Well, that didn't answer the man's question, did it? Because he said if God was omniscient, then he knew what was going to happen as a result of giving man free will. And if he doesn't have a decree, he's still stuck with absolutely senseless evil and has no purpose. That's why I'm a Reformed apologist. I don't know how anybody else can be anything other, to be perfectly honest with you. How do you really think that's a satisfying answer? I don't know. I just don't know. Two more clips from this, and then we'll go to some other material, but we're actually going to go ahead and take a brief break here. It's the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back.
How the Pilgrim's Progress is not an easy way. It's a journey to the sun, day by day. Following Jesus is a walk of praise.
BibleWorks 8 is here. Full of innovative and essential tools, users will have 190-plus Bible translations, 35 original language text and morphology databases, 29 lexical grammatical references, and an abundance of additional resources. Pastors, you will appreciate the phrase matching tool, which will allow you to find all of the verses containing phrases similar to your search verse, giving you greater depth and keener insight during sermon preparation. Seminary professors and students will be enriched by the way BibleWorks 8 shows the most common words in the pericope, book, or chapter, plus provides a wider range of formatting options and faster access to copying preferences. Scholars, your research just got easier with the ERMI, External Resources Manager, a handy tool to collect, organize, and display resource files from your computer as well as the internet. Dr. James White says, BibleWorks is the best Bible software available. I have used BibleWorks software for years, and each new release has brought many new and useful tools to the program. This is the program that runs 24/7 on my office computer, and it is the one that's running on my laptop when I engage in debates. It is simply the number one research tool for anyone doing serious exegesis of the text. For over 15 years, BibleWorks has assisted all users in their study of the original languages, and that enables you to do one thing, focus on the text. And that translates to focusing on the truth. Order your copy of BibleWorks at aomen.org, and for a limited time, you will receive free shipping and a free MP3 download of the White Airman Debate.
The Trinity is a basic teaching of the Christian faith. It defines God's essence and describes how He relates to us. James White's book, The Forgotten Trinity, is a concise, understandable explanation of what the Trinity is and why it matters. It refutes cultic distortions of God, as well as showing how a grasp of this significant teaching leads to renewed worship and deeper understanding of what it means to be a Christian. And amid today's emphasis on the renewing work of the Holy Spirit, The Forgotten Trinity is a balanced look at all three persons of the Trinity. Dr. John MacArthur, senior pastor of Grace Community Church, says, James White's lucid presentation will help layperson and pastor alike. Highly recommended. You can order The Forgotten Trinity by going to our website at aomen.org.
Hello, everyone. This is Rich Pierce. In a day and age where the gospel is being twisted into a man-centered self-help program, the need for a no-nonsense presentation of the gospel has never been greater. I am convinced that a great many go to church every Sunday, yet they have never been confronted with their sin. Alpha and Omega Ministries is dedicated to presenting the gospel in a clear and concise manner, making no excuses. Man is sinful and God is holy. That sinful man is in need of a perfect Savior, and Jesus Christ is that perfect Savior. We are to come before the holy God with an empty hand of faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. Alpha and Omega takes that message to every group that we deal with, while equipping the body of Christ as well. Support Alpha and Omega Ministries and help us to reach even more with the pure message of God's glorious grace. Thank you.
And welcome back to The Fighting Line. That was not an act of rebellion on Rich's part. I can see him in there staring at the screen going, why isn't there any sound coming out of the computer? I don't know why. So it was not a, no, we do not have any bumper music. But obviously, this proves once again that we need new bumper music. That's what we need. And there are CDs out there to help Rich with that particular. That particular thing. Anyway. All right, let's continue on. I've got two more clips here and still lots to do. We are going to fill up the 90 minutes today and make your head explode. So here we go.
Next question, please.
My question is for Mr. Barker and Mr. D'Souza. And I was just wondering what both of you thought of why women are almost universally excluded from religious decision-making hierarchies, and specifically Christianity.
Go ahead.
Can you tell you're at Harvard? Religious decision-making hierarchies. I like that. You can tell you're at Harvard.
There is a book written by a noted evolutionary biologist that is called The Inevitability of Patriarchy. It's an important book because it makes a Darwinian argument. By the way, seconded by leading atheists like Steven Pinker, I believe now at Harvard, formerly at MIT, arguing that these male-female differences are rooted in evolutionary biology. In other words, religion doesn't invent these things. The argument is, and this is an argument made with impeccable scientific and atheist credentials, that these things are in nature. And in a sense, you might say, religion assigns differential sacramental authority based on these presumed differences. Now, frankly, I doubt the biology.
because this is a case where a theological argument is sitting on top of what is presumed to be natural. The same, by the way, the debate about homosexuality, same thing. The idea that homosexuality is unnatural is not an invention of religion. People didn't say, oh, you know what, the book of Leviticus, and therefore,
time.
No.
I suppose there have been some times when I just took the wrong track. And when you've only got 90 seconds, you have no idea what it's like to try to, if you've not done this before, you have no idea what it's like to try to create a coherent response in only 90 seconds. It's not easy. But I can criticize because I do it all the time. So, but what was that? It's like he has an absolute clear and obvious aversion to anything biblical. You know, I mean, how would I respond to that? Well, I would go to the Bible and explain the consistent teaching of the Bible and maybe Paul's discussion of it wasn't Adam who was deceived, it was the woman. And I don't know, that might be some place you'd be willing to go. I mean, instead you start talking about evolutionary biology that you then disagree with, which of course just led into, I didn't play it, but led into Dan Barker being able to just go, ah, actually, that's very obvious. Religion was just borrowing from evolutionary biology, which demonstrates that that religion is secondary. It comes afterwards and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's just set up. It's a complete setup. Okay, finally, last one. This is the one where I, about halfway through this, through D'Souza's response, I went, would you just think and answer the question? But part of the reason that he can't is because his theology doesn't allow him to. And you're going to hear some really questionable theology come out here. So, you know, again, the man sounds like a wonderfully nice fellow, but you know what? If you're going to engage in debates like this, you might want to take some time to find out what you believe. Even, I can just imagine a lot of Roman Catholic apologists sitting around going, at some of these things. But this one especially, this is the one where if you're out in your backyard this morning near a certain canal and you saw a guy going by at about 18-2 going, would you just answer the question? This is the one that got me going.
Mr. D'Souza, I recently read your book and you were kind enough to respond to a couple of emails that I sent you. I really didn't feel like you answered my question, so I want to try it again. And I appreciate the fact that you brought up something just absolutely wrong, 6 million Jews. And I feel like I'm really quite sympathetic to faith, but certain things to me just seem to be so unethical that I have to reject them. Now, it seems that there's Jesus loves you Christianity and you love Jesus or you go to hell Christianity. And I'm wondering, the 6 million Jews that were murdered by the Nazis and their supporters, hundreds of millions of Christians still are taught and believe that if those Jews died, apparently not believing in Jesus, they would go to hell. Whether it's Anne Frank or the Polish doctor who went to Treblinka with the orphans.
Please.
The question is right here. So, do you believe in a Christ where there's any possibility at all that Jews murdered for being Jews could be sent to hell or denied access to heaven because they died as Jews, not as Christians?
Now, I stop right there. Now, I fully understand this guy. This is a trap. This is meant to inflame emotion. I understand all of those things. But if you're standing in front of an audience, you have to give a clear answer. One of the things I'm going to get to here, if I have time, and I will, is a section in Dan Barker's book, Godless, where he evaluates his own debates, including this one. And it's very painfully clear that Dan did not realize how badly Doug Wilson took him to the woodshed in 1997. He thinks he did this. He thinks he's the one who did it, as we're going to see here in a moment, because he just doesn't understand. And you cannot stand in front of this group and say, oh, man, if I say what I really need to say here, the majority of these people are not going to like me. You're not there for the majority of the people. You're there for an audience of one, at least if you're being a biblical apologist. You're there first for an audience of one. You are an ambassador. You have to speak Christ's truth. You can't worry about the response of the people in front of you. That's A. B, if you really believe what you're saying is true and you really believe the Spirit of God is going to use the truth of God to draw the people of God into salvation, then you don't have to worry about this stuff. That's why theology matters. That's why being an Arminian apologist or Roman Catholic apologist, by definition, will have to cripple what you're saying. Because you're trying to appeal to the natural man on the wrong basis. That's the whole thing. Now listen to what happens. Here's where I just...
Any possibility?
Well, I wouldn't answer as to possibilities, but I will say
I'm asking you if you believe there's any possibility. That's the question.
Is there any
possibility that Jesus Christ would deny access to heaven or send people to hell because they were murdered by Nazis for being Jews and they died as Jews, not Christians, and they knew about Christianity and didn't believe it?
Let me clarify. You're saying that you're trying to hold me to the proposition that all 6 million Jews, by virtue of being killed by Hitler, should be given automatic entree to heaven?
No, just the ones that were good people but didn't believe
in Jesus. Sorry, there shouldn't be any back and forth now. You have 1 minute to the question.
Look. I'll answer your question in general about non-believers. Is that satisfactory?
No, because that's not answering my question. Please answer the question.
Just answer the question!
He has 1 minute to speak.
Okay, well, I think you're trying to appropriate, if you will, the moral horror of the Holocaust to try to score a theological point, whereas I'm addressing the question at its deep principled core, which is, as a Christian, what do I think is going to happen to non-Christians? Right? Are they denied salvation? My answer is, as far as I know, no. But I don't know. Look, the Christianity states a positive teaching, which is to say, Christ is the way to heaven. If you embrace Christ, this is where you're going. You will have salvation in some profound sense. I do want to note, by the way, that for many leading atheists, and I mentioned Christopher Hitchens here very clearly, he says, look, I don't want to go to heaven. He says, it's like celestial North Korea. He says, I don't want to stand and hand out garlands. He says, I'd rather stay out of it. If there's a place like that, count me out. I think this is very important because in Christian theology, it's not that God is grabbing the atheist and flinging him into hell. The atheist, in a sense, the Bible says in a very profound verse, the salvation is the gift of God. Okay, now, many people think this means God gives us the gift of salvation. Wrong. Salvation is not the gift from God.
Time.
Salvation is the gift of God. God is the gift.
Time. That is not what Ephesians 2 says, actually. I guess we're a good either universalist or inclusivist. There you go, Roman Catholics. I thought that the magisterium cleared all these things up and created absolute unanimity. Evidently not, since we all know the majority of the magisterium are inclusivists or universalists today. Anyways, but there you go. Man, I wish I knew who that fellow was, because I would like to show him enough respect to answer his question directly from a biblical perspective. And to do that, you have to first, did you hear what he said? They were good people but didn't believe in Jesus. Sir, there's no such thing. That's the whole point. Heaven is not something that people are shut out of. No one deserves it. God would be perfectly just to let all of us run straight into the buzzsaw of his just, righteous law. And every single one of us will fall short. That is fundamental to Christianity. You cannot even begin to define what Christianity believes if you don't recognize the universal sinfulness of man and the righteousness of God and the punishment thereof. In fact, may I suggest to you that in light of Romans chapter 3, verses 18 and 19, the person who still stands before God mouthing his own self-righteousness is the person who is not yet ready to hear about the gospel of grace. And so, first and foremost, sir, every person, I don't care who they are, Jew, Nazi, Russian, Chinese, African, it doesn't matter. Heaven is closed to them by their sin, righteously and justly so. And this is such a common objection. It's a common objection to God's justice. It is not one that's going to fly before the throne of God, I assure you of that. But if all you want to do is create emotions amongst people, well, you'll answer for doing that. That's for certain. But here was a perfect opportunity to talk about God's holiness, to talk about God's justice. But theology matters, and Romanist theology is not Christianity. Rome has the wrong gospel. That's the whole point. And you just saw it in glowing colors presented before you in the non-answer to the man's question. Right there, right in front of you. Amazing. Absolutely amazing stuff. Well, that's why I was muttering loudly, actually yelling, while writing. And some of the rest of you are doing the same thing. I'm reading Godless by Dan Barker, and I ran into a very interesting section. Page 83, and once again, I need to clip on my uber-duber cool CSI New York glasses here so I can read. If you don't know what those are, you haven't been watching my videos. Page 83 of Godless. We free thinkers want to do the opposite of something Jesus did. That's why I love debates and my new, quote, calling, end quote. Dan loves debates. He considers it a calling. And so this whole section, beginning back, let's see here, chapter 4 starts on page 67, The New Call, is about his engaging in debates. And Dan's done a lot of debates. I've done more than Dan, but just barely. He's done a lot of debates, and he started doing them early on, and it was fascinating reading his section about Doug Wilson. Because we played this section just a few weeks ago from his debate with Doug Wilson. And I'll start on page 69. I debated Doug Wilson twice, once at the University of Delaware, and again in his hometown of Moscow, Idaho. I didn't know about the second one. That's why I've now listened to the second one, as I learned it from reading the book. He is the author of Letter from a Christian Citizen, a response to Sam Harris's Letter to a Christian Nation, and a presuppositionalist Calvinist pastor. During our first debate, he claimed that without the Bible, there is no basis for morality. So I read him Psalm 137:9, which says, Happy shall he be that taketh and dasheth thy little ones against the stones. I then asked, is it moral to throw little babies against rocks? With little hesitation, he replied, yes, it is. I'm paraphrasing from memory. Probably be good to listen to it again, Dan. Because I'm assuming, because of this, that Dan listens to everything that I've said. I'm sure he's listening to all the Dividing Lines, that he's searched the website for everything about Dan Barker. So, hi, Dan. How you doing? Haven't talked to you in a long, long time. We both had hair the last time we met. Doesn't look like either one of us have much of it left. There was audible gasping from members of the audience, including many Christians. I don't recall that that's what happened. And, in fact, I hope he brings up Psalm 137. No one seemingly has talked about the fact that the real context of it. But Doug put it in the biblical context. And Dan doesn't seem to understand that he didn't raise an objection to the reality of what God was talking about in the punishment of the Babylonian people expressed in that psalm, in Psalm 137. Continuing on, according to Wilson, we mortals are incapable of making moral judgments on our own and must submit to the superior wisdom of God. No, actually what Doug said is that we all make moral decisions, but they are perverted when we do not make them in accordance with God's revelation because we're sinners. And the very fact he doesn't get this either indicates dishonesty, or I think Dan just has no idea what Reformed people believe. I think that's why he kept shooting and missing in the Wilson debate, and it hasn't changed, and which means it won't change next week unless something happens. If the Bible says we should be happy or blessed, as some translations render it, to kill the innocent children of those who worship other gods, excuse me, they're not innocent children, that's the whole point, then it would be immoral not to do it. I then switched to the Christian scriptures and read from Luke 12:47-48, where Jesus demonstrated his compassion by advising us that there are some slaves who should not be beat as hard as other slaves because they didn't know any better. That slave who knew what his master wanted but did not prepare himself or do what was wanted will receive a severe beating, but the one who did not know and did what deserved a beating will receive a light beating, in RSV. I asked Doug in front of the stunned audience, is it a good idea to beat your slaves? He replied, yes, it is, another gasp from the audience. That wasn't the whole discussion, obviously. Doug did take the time to discuss the... In fact, Doug even asked, are you talking about the Hebrew law in regards to slavery, or are you talking about the Roman law? And that doesn't show up here. I was expecting Wilson to be a compassionate Christian, an attempt to apply a modern interpretation. I wonder what modern interpretation means. I suppose that means some modern way of trying to get around what it meant in the original context. Claiming context or metaphor, or insist that Jesus was simply giving an example of what does happen, not what should be done. But there is no need to defend the Bible when all we have to do is blindly obey it. In Wilson's mind, slavery is not a bad idea, since the Bible commands it, and Jesus not only never condemns it, but also incorporates it into his teachings, if it were the most natural order, which it was with, to the authors of the Bible. By the way, I just remembered, I didn't comment on something. What an incredibly absurd argument to say Jesus never talked about unwanted pregnancies, therefore Christians shouldn't say anything about it. The problem, and I'm not the only one who's pointed this out, Dan Barker was a fundamentalist Pentecostal charismatic. Okay? He had a very shallow understanding of the Bible and interpretation of the Bible. Problem is, he still is. He's still a fundamentalist. He's just now a fundamentalist, humanist, naturalist, materialist. Darwinian. Though he contradicts his Darwinianism all the time. But he's still a fundamentalist. He still engages in very simplistic reasoning on these matters. He clearly, as in his education, which he himself calls glorified Sunday school, never dealt with any type of serious Christian theology or systematic theology or discussion of any of these things. So he doesn't have any basis for even understanding a biblical doctrine of life and the protection of life and an objection to abortion. So to say, well, Jesus never objected to that, that's like saying Jesus never objected to internet porn. Well, how meaningful is that? It's not meaningful at all to anybody who's serious anyways in their thinking. If you don't want to be serious in your thinking, then, you know, whatever. At least Wilson is consistent, I'll give him that, consistently awful. During our second debate, attended by many Calvinist ministers, I told the horrible story of how John Calvin had co-reformer Michael Servetus. Co-reformer. Michael Servetus is a co-reformer. In his mind, he was. And one of the things, and if Dan's listening, and again, hi, Dan. One of the things that I would really like to ask is, in light of Dan's definition of morality, where to be moral is to simply do that which causes the least harm, or which eliminates harm. That is such a simplistic definition. It cannot begin to answer a simple question. Why does Dan Barker lie about John Calvin? Well, since John Calvin's dead, then no one can be harmed by it, so I guess that would be a moral thing for an atheist to do. But I've listened, and I've got it queued up here, and I don't think we're going to get to it, but I've listened to what he says about Dan, about Tim Barker, about John Calvin. And he's, again, either ignorant or grossly dishonest, one of the two, about this subject. And when people, you know, accuse him of not knowing these things, well, I was right where you are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I told the horrible story of how John Calvin had co-reformer Michael Servetus burned at the stake for the crime of questioning his scriptural interpretations. Not only did Wilson not join me in denouncing Calvin, he came to his defense. Well, how could he not, being a Calvinist pastor? Anyone who holds John Calvin in high regard, I told that audience, is morally bankrupt. Yes, it is what he said. I have that queued up here. But that was after lying about John Calvin and ignoring vast portions of history. And between now and next, and 2 weeks from now, I'm going to need to put together a brief description of Dan's activities that ignores the vast majority of what Dan says about his own conversion, and present that and say, you have no moral standing to say that that's wrong because you ignored everything about the history of the Servetus incident. You ignored Calvin's risking his life to meet Servetus many years earlier. All your presentation. In fact, I've got it queued up, so I'll play. Well, let's go ahead and play a section. We got a few moments. Let's listen to a portion of this very debate, the very thing that he was reporting in his. Well, wait a minute. Here's why I can't. Because I got to read this. We'll do it next time. 90 minutes is a long time. One of the things that's fascinating to me is he didn't mention this in his book. Is I discovered a little something. Remember the section of the debate where they talked about capital punishment and a jury? And Doug Wilson went through the fact that he was the foreman on the jury. And I thought it was an excellent exchange because it demonstrated the shallow nature of Dan's objections, and I thought Doug did a great job. Well, guess what I discovered? Dan Barker knew that Doug had been on that jury before they went to the debate, and it was his purpose to get him to raise this so that he could raise the shallow objection of two witnesses. Remember the two witnesses thing? We all sort of chuckled because, you know, obviously it was an acontextual reading. It was a blind fundamentalist reading of the text. Well, you got to have two eyewitnesses. We can't make any application. DNA, no, DNA can't. No, I handle snakes, too. That's the kind of Christianity that Dan Barker objects to. And he doesn't want anyone to recognize that there is a higher form of Christianity that takes the Bible very seriously, still can believe it's inerrant, and the Bible's inerrant, and yet make application of principles. No, can't do that. I discovered that, I believe it was Farrell Till, had sent to Dan Barker information about Doug Wilson serving on that very jury prior to that. Here is a email dated 13 March 1997 to Ralph Nielsen from Dan Barker. Ralph, the debate was great. All the free thinkers in the audience agreed that I nailed Wilson on many points. So he wants to nail people. That's why he does debates. He wants to nail people. So we're going to have very different reasons for being there right from the start. I think he was surprised that I was ready for him. I actually was able to use his jury experience against him, and he fell right into it. He doesn't know that I knew the story because I framed it hypothetically, and he volunteered that he was foreman of that jury. So I just asked, quote, innocent, end quote, questions. He eagerly stated that he would have recommended the death penalty for the convicted murderer. I got him to claim that his verdict was a biblically based, morally correct decision. When I then asked him how many witnesses there were to the crime, he looked very uncomfortable, mumbled something about more than one line of evidence. He didn't mumble it. I heard it quite clearly. We had already established the two or three witnesses requirement from an earlier line of questioning. I pressed him on how many witnesses testified they saw the murder, and he admitted none. You'll have to see the tape to see how it went. That was just a tiny part of the whole evening, but I was very happy to have that card up my sleeve. I got him to contradict himself on a few other matters as well. The next day, Wilson and I had a long, friendly chat. I told him that I had heard from a member of ours in Idaho that he was something of a local personage. He asked me for the name of this member, and I didn't tell him, not knowing how you would feel about it. Thanks again for your help. So this was Ralph Nielsen. Maybe that's the one. Ralph Nielsen is the one who sent it to him. But I think Farrell Till was involved in somehow getting this information to him. Then, also on 13 March, another email from Dan, and I'll read quickly here. My debate with Doug Wilson Tuesday night at the University of Delaware was very successful. 500, 600 people, maybe one of them were atheist agnostics. Many were bused in from Maryland churches, including some with children, and many were university students. The atheists and agnostics in the audience told me that I won the debate handily. Wilson stuck to his transcendental argument, and I was prepared. Okay. See how vastly different this sounds, given your presuppositions? Thanks to the Internet for resources such as Martin's Tang and other articles, Michael Martin's refutation of Tag was extremely helpful in giving me the jump on Wilson. That was one of the most pathetic arguments I've ever heard when he presented, remember? I got Wilson to contradict himself blatantly a number of times during cross-examination. His attempts to weasel out of them were pathetic, although there were many amens from the audience as he did this. But I was totally shocked by Wilson's attitude regarding morality. Totally shocked, capitalized. I hammered on him with numerous examples of cruelty committed or commanded by the God of the Bible and by Jesus. Instead of denying the cruelty or claiming that I was misinterpreting the Bible, Wilson agreed that the God of the Bible is cruel. Of course, Wilson actually pointed out that Dan didn't have any basis for defining cruelty, but that somehow doesn't make it into these. When I asked him if this cruelty was good, he said, yes, if God says that it is good, then it is good. He agreed that Jesus encouraged the beating of slaves, and that this is a good teaching. He agreed that God had said in Psalm 137 thing, and so on. I'm not kidding. You'll have to see the whole debate and see how it went. They'll be sending me an audio and a video cassette that we are free to distribute, etc., etc. Anyway, I feel pretty high about the debate and wanted to share it. Many of the internet infidels were very helpful during their preparation, and I am appreciative of that. So the question then is, how does Dan Barker's definition of morality deal with what he has admitted he did in that debate? And how does it deal with the amazing representations he makes of these debates? Because the funny thing is, I have now heard bunches of these debates before I read his own discussion of them. And I'm like, wow, someone has an interesting lack of contact with reality here. Is this really how he heard it? Is this how he's remembered these things? Fascinating stuff, truly is. And so next time we will get into Dan Barker's gross ignorance or misrepresentation or both of John Calvin in that second debate with Doug Wilson, because it's just really, really bad. Thanks for sticking around, those of you who have, for 90 minutes. I hope it's been useful to you. We'll be back again, Lord willing, on Tuesday morning. We'll see you then. God bless.
Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.